Tonight's event has been co-sponsored by, and I want you to give it up for, the Department of Religion. The Interfaith Center. The formidable Lang Center for Civil and Social Responsibility. The world famous Peace and Conflict Studies. No, it is world famous. And Swarthmore Progressive Christians. So here's the thing. Last year, I'm teaching a seminar at Temple University for grad students called Good and Evil. Actually, it was called Radical Good and Radical Evil. We didn't think the radical would fly around here, so we cut it out. And we read all sorts of classics of sort of radical altruism and radical evil of the 20th century. And we explored issues about goodness, the limits of agency and responsibility and what we can do for each other, and also the perverse limits of evil and cruelty and what people have done to each other. And the book I chose was a theologian's meditation on Christian forgiveness and charity, which didn't fly. And I was really disappointed it didn't fly. And then a few weeks later, I happened to pick up Shane's book, which is actually on sale afterwards in the back, The Irresistible Revolution. And I said, this is the book I should have assigned to these graduate students. I have not read in years a book of Christian faith that speaks so much to my non-Christian soul. And still non-Christian soul. That this text and Shane's world is an inspiration. An inspiration like his inspirations. Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Dorothy Day, and other sort of saintly figures of the good life. And so I started recommending it to all my friends as an example of an image of Christians, activists on the move, living a life, struggling to think and feel and discern what it means to be responsible in an urban American environment. So I can think of no other privilege than to actually have Shane Claiborne here and my students who have read his book this week here in the audience to talk to us about his life, his mission, and what's happened since this book has come out. Shane will tell you a little bit about his community, The Simple Way in Philadelphia, and I have made up some little sign-up sheets because they're very tech-savvy. You can follow them on Facebook, Twitter, their website, or just get an email from them. So please, let's give a big Swati welcome to Shane Claiborne. Thanks, Shane.
Well, I'm thrilled to be back at Swarthmore, and I'm excited about the conversation. In a little bit, we're just going to open it up, so I'm giving you the heads up. These are my notes. It's about six words on there. So it's like I really believe in conversation, but I'm you know, honored to be homework for some of you and to open up a conversation tonight. I grew up down in Tennessee, which is why I talk so cool. And you know, but it was like the Bible Belt, and I grew up very immersed in Christianity. But I began to feel a little bit of a disconnect as I kind of had my eyes opened up to the world a little bit, because a lot of what it seemed like the version of Christianity that I saw was offering was like life after death, whereas like it seemed like half the world was wondering if there's life before death, you know, and like if it kind of wondering how do we survive in the world, and if our faith isn't like relevant to the world that we live in, then you know what good really is it? you know that old saying, like my grandmother used to say, if you're not careful, your faith becomes so heavenly minded, it's no earthly good. And I saw a lot of Christians that we kind of were using our faith just as like a ticket into heaven and a license to ignore the hells of the world around us, you know. And yet then I started reading my Bible, and almost every time Jesus opens his mouth, he's talking about the kingdom of God, a very peculiar kind of phrase. That kingdom was the same word as empire, you know, and it was this idea of sort of God's dream coming, but it wasn't just something that we hope for when we die, but something that we're actually to be a part of inaugurating, you know, on earth as it is in heaven, as Jesus said. So I started seeing that and going, wow, this is a beautiful vision for how we can live. I mean, it kind of went a lot deeper than we used to have this thing in youth group called Heaven's Gates and Hell's Flames. I'm just going to give you a little flavor of it. Like, you know, if you've ever seen like youth group, I know a lot of you didn't grow up in like the youth group world, but like if you want to see like really bad theater, there's nothing worse than like you know, a junior high skit. But that, and so like you'd be driving the bus, I mean, and then like this is before an audience, and the bus would wreck, and like everybody would die, and demons would come and drag everybody that didn't know Jesus to hell. And my friend's dad was the devil, and he was really good. And like, you know, afterwards they would invite, you know, everybody to know Jesus. And like, I mean, everybody got saved. Even the pastor, I think, got born again again. And like, it was, but like, so I started seeing that and going, wow, like, I'm not sure, you know, where all this fits in. And so I came up to Philly. In part for me, it was to get out of that world and see the world a little bit. And so I wanted to study sociology, you know. But then I began, so that's what I majored in. But I also wasn't quite ready just to throw out, like, my faith. And I loved how Karl Barth said, we've got to read the Bible in one hand, but we need to read the newspaper in the other. Right? That our faith isn't just a ticket out of the world, but it's fuel to engage injustice and the brokenness of the world that we live in. And so that's what I studied. I studied the Bible and I studied sociology. But everything really kind of ignited for me in 1995 when I was studying at Eastern. And a group of homeless families, some of y'all on the older side will remember this, that dozens and dozens of homeless families had moved into an abandoned cathedral at 8th and York in North Philadelphia, and they were living there. This is at a time where there were 3,000 families on the waiting list for affordable housing. And what happened was heartbreaking. The archdiocese that owned the Catholic cathedral gave the families an eviction notice and told them that if they weren't out within 48 hours, then they could be arrested for trespassing on church property. Something about that just didn't feel right, you know? And, you know, there's kind of moments where you go, God, why don't you do something? And we sort of felt God go, I did do something. I made you, you know, get out. And we went down and we found the cathedral that night, actually. And on the front of the cathedral, the families had hung a banner that said, how can we worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore one on Monday? And it really opened our eyes both to kind of seeing Jesus and our faith differently, and also to seeing the struggle of homeless families. And and that lasted, like, not for 48 hours, but for months and months and months. And it was kind of a whole movement on Eastern's campus. I'm happy to say we also had some Swarthmore students involved. And, that standoff, there's all kinds of stuff that happened. I mean, the media got pretty involved and made it look like the church was kicking homeless people out. And that's because the church was kicking homeless people out, you know. And so that... But that's what we always track as kind of the spark that lit the fire. You know, like that was the seed that turned into what we now have in our community. And out of that, a group of college friends and I, we just moved in together and continued living in that neighborhood. In fact, just a couple years ago, my wife and I got married in the old abandoned cathedral. It's been an incredible struggle, not my marriage, it's been entering into some of the injustice and the pain, but it's also a place where we found hope. You know, a lot of times I say, that neighborhoods that are economically struggling are often community rich, and likewise, neighborhoods that are often community rich or like economically rich or community poor, you know, you don't know all your neighbors. So like our neighborhood is post-industrial wreckage of you know, urban America. We've lost over 150,000 jobs. We've got 700 abandoned factories, 20,000 vacant houses. So that's our little world. And, so when we moved in, we found that when you move into a neighborhood that's got so much abandonment, there's a lot of room for resurrection, you know. And we found that we could buy a house for a dollar. Not bad. Little different from Swarthmore. But anyway, so we pulled our money together. We've been moving into abandoned houses and into planting gardens on vacant lots. And so now it feels a lot like we've been building a village together, you know, and we've been trying to grow a neighborhood in the midst of that kind of industrial ruins that we live in. And now, like our latest project is some of you are, you know, on the smarty pants on your whole like if you've studied urban farming and urban gardening, like one of the cutting edge sort of things is aquaponics, you know. And so that's what we've been doing now. So we dug down into the basement of an abandoned house, and the house was like leveled because there was a fire, and we dug down and we created a 1,800 gallon fish pond where we can raise about 1,000 fish, and then that water pumps through, and we've got solar panels and all that stuff in it. Is filtered through raised bed gardens back to the fish, and so it's a really beautiful way of growing food in the nutritional desert. And we picked a carrot this morning, you know, in 20 degree weather in Philadelphia. But like that's part of what we get to see, you know, is we get to see life flourish again. And there's something I think to be said about neighborhoods that have had the life sucked out of them, like much of Kensington. And so if you grow up in a neighborhood where a lot of what you look at is ugly, it's hard to be convinced that there's a beautiful creator, you know? And when we lose connection to life, then a culture of death kind of often prevails. And so part of what we do is, as theologian Wendell Berry, he calls it practicing resurrection, you know, is that we practice resurrection by trying to bring dead things to life and make ugly things beautiful. So we paint murals on walls, you know, and we make gardens out of vacant lots and bring dead houses back to life, and I guess try to love all each other back to life too. When kids, you know, pick a carrot out of the ground, it's like magic to them, you know. I mean, a lot of the kids, some of the kids in our neighborhood have seen gardens, but others, like, they haven't, you know. So we asked one of the kids what grows on an eggplant, and they're like, eggs, of course. But seeing that connection happen, I mean, this year, one of the kids ran down like ballistic, was like, come here, come here, come here. I'm like, what? And they said, you got to see this. They pulled me down, and the kid was like, what is that? I'm like, that's a firefly. And I thought, how awesome, right? And they said, what is a firefly? And I'm like, a firefly was a created, it was a, just a really, really creative day for God. God was like, I'm going to make a bug that's butt clothes. You know, that, I mean, that's what it is. And so I love the magic. You know, that's part of what we get to participate in. And so above all the, you know, like, big ideas and academic stuff, I think that's really, really important. That's why I come to find places like this. But really, like, to me, my heart's there in the neighborhood. And what we're doing is very, very spiritual. You know, it's connecting to God and loving our neighbors and trying to imagine what it would look like if God's dream really did come to Kensington. You know, what if God's dream really did come on earth, what would that look like? And so all of the other stuff that we do as far as like social justice stuff and peace stuff, I saw the poster, so I got to mention those a couple times. And it's bubbled up out of living in the neighborhood, you know? And personally, I think that to be being a Christian to me, part of what I love and identify with is the story of Jesus to me is about God moving into the neighborhood, and a neighborhood where people said nothing good could come. That's exactly what they said in Nazareth, right? Nothing good could come out of there. So always when people refer to my neighborhood, as they often do, as the Badlands, that's what a lot of folks call Kensington, right? I'm like, you better be careful if you call a place that, because that's exactly what they said in Nazareth, and look what showed up, you know? So I believe that beautiful things kind of come out of the abandoned and broken places. And part of what Christ compels me to is to move closer to the suffering, closer to the pain of the world rather than further away. And everything in our world is compelling us the other direction, right? To move away from pain, to move away from suffering, to move away from neighborhoods where there's high crime or there's people that don't look like us. But that compelling sense that God is in touch with the pain and enters into the pain is really what we're up to. And then the other stuff comes out of that. So one of the first things that we began to encounter in as we lived in Kensington and in Philadelphia in general was anti-homeless laws, you know, that were specifically targeting the homeless. And this swept across the country. There's 50 cities that have like very particular laws that make it illegal to sleep in public parks, illegal to, you know, lie down on the sidewalk or ask for change on the streets and things like that. So Philly has kind of constantly been passing laws like that we've, you know, kind of tried to raise questions about. Well, I mean, this past year, the Mayor Nutter declared an anti-feeding ordinance. Do you remember this? I mean, this is last year. And so we were a big part of trying to raise attention around that, because the ban would have been that you can't feed more than four people in a public place. And that we found that problematic. And so, like, what was beautiful, though, was that people of faith and conscience really came out of the woodwork to protest that food ban. And last I heard, we actually won but from a federal judge that said it was a violation of religious freedom, because what we were saying that is to share food with the hungry is a fundamental practice of our faith. And to say that we cannot feed a homeless person is to say that we cannot feed Christ, because in the end, we believe that that's part of what we're participating in. So I thought it was kind of interesting that it was, you know, religious freedom that we got that on. But those laws, like, we kind of see them everywhere. In fact, another really great story from our neighborhood was there's a Pentecostal church around the corner that was welcoming homeless folks, and the city cracked down on them and said, you don't have all the permits and licenses to run a shelter. And so we're shutting this thing down. And these guys are Pentecostals. You don't mess with the Pentecostals. You know what I'm saying? And so they were like, we'll pray about this, and we'll talk in a week or something, you know? And so, like, they came back to the city and they said, we want you to know that we respect you and we hear what you've said, that we can't run a shelter. So we're not going to run a shelter, but we are going to be the church. And the church welcomes people. And so we won't call it a shelter, though. We'll call it a revival. And they said, we're going to have a revival, and it's going to start every night at about 8 o'clock, and it'll go to the next morning. And they said, anybody will be welcome. And I it was great because I went to the revival one night, and it was like 2 hours of singing and people sharing their stories and some reading from Scripture. And then after like 2 hours, one of the pastors said, okay, that concludes our formal service. The next 8 hours will be silent meditation. Everybody have a good night. And far as I know, that revival's still going, you know. But it's that courage and imagination that I think is so beautiful. And so we've been able to see, you know, expressions of that bubble up. Another big one for us over the past few years has been around the gun violence, right? And as many of you probably know, there's just an epidemic of gun violence in Philadelphia and around the country. It's about 10,000 murders a year in the U.S., and we've been having almost one a day in Philadelphia. Many of those are in our zip code. And so there was a study just done that showed it's more likely for an African-American man to get killed in Philadelphia than it is in Afghanistan or Iraq. And there is that violence that we see on the streets, like, it's not just a debate about gun violence, but it's a 19-year-old kid, you know, that we saw shot on our front steps. And so eventually I think what happens is we start to ask fundamental questions, right? Like Dr. Martin Luther King said, we're called to be the good Samaritan and lift our neighbor out of the ditch, you know, referring to the old story in the scripture. Like, we're called to be the good Samaritan, says Martin Luther King. But he says, after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you start to say, maybe the whole road to Jericho needs to be rethought. You know, we start to say, like, what's landing people in the ditch? And it was Dr. King that also connected the culture of violence in the world, you know, and he said, I've told kids in the ghettos that violence won't solve their problems, but then they ask me, why does our government use massive doses of violence to try to bring the change it wants in the world? And Dr. King said, I knew that I could no longer speak against the violence of the ghettos without speaking against the violence of my government. So that connection to us is a local one of trying to cut down the violence on our streets, and we've tried to do a lot around that. You know, we've done protests outside of the gun shops, and we've, you know, lobbied and done all this stuff. But at the end of the day, we're, you know, teaching our kids nonviolence, and that nonviolence is rooted in Jesus, and like what we see Jesus interacting with when he's on the cross is, as people are pouring out tremendous violence, he says, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And it's that powerful nonviolence that we see. You know, it's possible that love can conquer hatred. And as the early Christians said, that grace can dull even the sharpest sword. But that also, like, kind of takes a witness outside the neighborhood, which I'm just one of the kids. Right after September 11th, I was talking to one of our kids that had seen a lot of violence, and it was September 12th, you know, right after the attacks on 9/11, and I said, what do you think we should do about this? And he was like 9 years old, I think, at the time, and Stephen, the young kid, he goes, well, those people did something very, very evil and wrong. And I said, yeah, they did. Someone did. And Stephen said, but I always say, he's nine, right? But I always say, two wrongs don't make a right. It doesn't make sense for us to try to hurt them back to show what they did to us is wrong. Beautiful, right? And after that, I, you know, began to also hear about victims of 9/11 that had gone to Iraq and Afghanistan to try to build bridges and be reconcilers. And so I was kind of commissioned from our community and neighborhood to go to Iraq. And the first time I went was in March of 2003. So it was exactly 10 years ago next month. And that was during the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad and all the, you know, I was there during the bombing, lived in Baghdad, and saw some of the hardest things, you know, I've ever seen in my life. And yet it was there, just like in my neighborhood, that I saw hope and grace and compassion in ways that I think sometimes in the darkest spaces we find like the brightest hope, you know. And as we were there, really the kind of pinnacle story for us was as we were there for a whole month and leaving Baghdad, we had a car accident, and these Iraqi doctors saved our life. Two of my friends had head injuries after the car accident, and so they were taken in, and these doctors saved our life, only to tell us minutes later that 2 days before, our country had bombed and hit their hospital, and so the hospital had been destroyed in the bombing, and yet these doctors saved our lives, you know. And and those experiences have been so moving. It's actually been so that experience 10 years ago was so amazing that our friends down in North Carolina in Durham, they started a community named after the town. It's called Rutba House, and it's named after a little town, Anbar province in Iraq, and committed to reconciliation. And so it's always been our dream to go back. So just a couple years ago, we got to go back to Iraq, and we found those doctors that had saved our life. And when we came back, they threw us like the biggest party I've ever seen in my life. Like the whole town had gathered, and they brought us in. They're like, you don't understand. We don't get many visitors, you know. And they said, now there are a few people that would want to kill you, but not many. And they said, so we'll take care of you. And they slept by our beds with AK-47s. And I'm like, that doesn't fit into my theology, but man, I'm grateful for your hospitality, you know. And and so we had these, you know, conversations, and we met with the mayor of Rutba, and the mayor's like, this is the stuff that remakes the world, you know. He's like, we need to keep these friendships going. And then he said, we need a sister city in the United States. And I'm like, Philadelphia, you know. And he's like, no, Philadelphia is so big. Our town is just a little bitty town. He said, we need a little town in the United States. And then he starts talking to his friend in Arabic. And he says, there's one little town I've been to. Have you ever heard of Durham, North Carolina? And I'm just like, I immediately tears start rolling down my face. And I'm like, are you kidding me? There's a community in Durham, North Carolina called Rutba House, named after your town. And the mayor's like, then it's done! And he says, and then the mayor goes, and we will have a community for peace in Rutba called Durham House. And like, awesome, you know? So like, out of that, we started this whole kind of movement called Friends Without Borders, you know, to try to create friendships across conflict. But in the end, like, it's still really rooted in our neighborhood. So like, now, last month, I got to go to Afghanistan and meet these youth in Afghanistan. They got incredible dreams for a peaceful Afghanistan. And they've got like a campaign, because, you know, for the last 30 years, Afghanistan's been at war, and they've lost 2 million people there. And so these young people have a whole campaign now of Friends Without Borders that's called 2 Million Friends for the 2 Million Dead. So they're kind of inviting all of us around the world to be their friends to help remake the world together. So what was cool was we had a Skype call. This is the technology, isn't it? Like, where we had kids on my block in Kensington call kids in Kabul, and they listened to these kids in Kabul share about their dreams for the world, right? A world where they don't have to worry about their friends getting killed. And And you know what the kids on my block are thinking as they hear that? Those are the same dreams, right? We got the same dreams, not to see our friends killed on our streets. And so it's that kind of stuff that intersects for us all in this kind of this idea that we are to participate in the coming of God's dream in our neighborhoods and in our world. And I was just with a rabbi, Elliot and I were talking about Rabbi Michael Lerner. He popped by the house and he says, people sometimes will call you idealistic. And he says, when they say that, you should say, you're darn right we're idealistic. Like, to be realistic is idolatry, because it says that we can just allow what exists to continue to happen. And he said, idealism is about demanding the impossible and realizing that we have a God that is transforming the world, you know? So I love the verse in Hebrews that says, we are certain of what we hope for and sure of what we don't yet see. Or as one of my friends says, we believe despite the evidence and we watch the evidence change. So folks would say that, you know, Kensington is beyond redemption, or our world is beyond redemption, or poverty is always going to exist, or we can't live without war. We would say that that's idealistic, right? To continue to spend $20,000 a second on war, as we do right now, is unrealistic, right? Is shameful. And so, like, what does God's dream look like? Well, it looks different from $20,000 a second on war. It looks different from having what we have in the U.S., which is 100,000 Hiroshima bombs. It looks different from a world where 5% of the world is consuming half the world's stuff, right? So what does it look like to reimagine the world together? And I think probably one of the most memorable experiences in my life was when I was in Baghdad during the bombing, and there was a doctor that was holding this kid that's body was riddled with missile fragments. And as he held this kid, the bombs were still falling from the sky, and he held his hands up and he said, this is for a world that has lost its imagination. And what I get excited about and why I come to groups, especially love, you know, folks like you're young. You haven't been convinced that, you know, anything's impossible. And I think that that's where, like, what each of us gets to ask is, how do I fit into that story? You know, how, like, I love how Frederick Buechner says, we've got to take our deepest passions and connect them to the world's deepest pain. So you take your gifts and you bring them to the world's pain, and we begin to see things transform. You know, I met these robotics engineers the other day. They make robots. How cool is that? You know, and I'm sitting with them, and they're like, yeah, but we're not making robots just so we can make money. We thought we need to do something meaningful in the world, you know. And so they said they're designing robots that can dismantle landmines. So they can, because they heard that little kids in Afghanistan were being paid to dismantle landmines. They get their fingers blown off, you know, as they do it. And he said, so we're robotics engineers in a think tank that are designing robots that can dismantle landmines so we can send them over to Afghanistan. You know, met these other folks that are like scientists that are deeply concerned that the biggest cause of death in the world is lack of access to clean water, you know, and they're like, this is something we can figure out. And so they're studying bacteria, they're studying clean water technology, you know. And as they're doing that, these business folks came up and they said, you know what? Here's a sad fact for you. In industrialized countries, we spend enough money on bottled water that if we just reallocated the money we spend on bottled water, and we drink tap water because it's usually a few feet away, you know, and we could provide water access for the rest of the world with indigenous labor, you know. And so now what they do is they started a bottled water company that basically bottles tap water. And by basically, I mean they bottle tap water, and they sell it. And all of the money that they make goes to dig wells with indigenous labor. And every bottle of water, it says, when I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. You know, and now they're working with those engineers that designed playgrounds, like, you know, with the merry-go-rounds that pump water. They double as water pumps. So as the kids run on them, you know, they pump water for the village. And some things have worked and some haven't. But they're like, they're doing it together, you know. So that's like what I offer to you, you know, as we open it up for conversation is this. We get to bring our gifts to the story. We get to I don't think everybody's got to do exactly what we're doing in North Philly, you know. I mean, actually, I'm really, really grateful all the times we've gone to jail that we got some good lawyers. Ka-ching! You know, that everybody gets to be a part of the story and bring their gifts and the things that you're learning, you know, to the remaking of the world. So, there you go. Some thoughts. So we'll be still like good Quakers and then open it up for conversation. Oh, that's so sweet. Thanks.